النقي means the pure, the immaculate, the clean. Al-Hadi means the guide. All the imams came for guidance.
As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt al-nubuwa wa mawdi' al-risala wa mukhtalaf al-malak.
Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety.
This is Dialogue, an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is Dialogue. I'm your host Mahdi. Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam was a pure source of wisdom and knowledge. Despite his young age, he showed what divinely gifted knowledge really looks like. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the 10th divinely appointed imam, and he was the 10th divinely appointed successor of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the son of the 9th divinely appointed imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. After Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam answered with the answers of an expert the most difficult of questions posed to him by the Shia scholars and jurisprudents, the Shia leaders at that time had more faith and certainty now of what they had previously believed, that a divinely appointed imam must have the most knowledge and he must be the most knowledgeable one of his time, regardless of whether he is young or old. And so the knowledge, virtue, and the delving into the sciences of the Holy Quran and the Sunnah of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam astonished the minds and sparked meetings and gatherings in all parts of the Muslim world. At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Jamiatul Kabira by Imam Hadi alayhi salam, along with its English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام على أئمة الهدى ومصابيح التجا وأعلام التقى وذوي النهى.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety, the owners of understanding, the endued with thoughts, the havens of the peoples, the inheritors of the prophets, the perfect specimen, the most excellent call in the arguments of Allah against the inhabitants of the world, the hereafter and the former world. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon you all.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Peace be upon the exponents of the recognition of Allah, the centers of Allah's blessing, the essence of Allah's wisdom, the keepers of Allah's secrets, the bearers of Allah's book, the successor of Allah's prophet, and the progeny of Allah's messenger. May Allah send blessings upon him and his household. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon them.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. As-salamu ala al-a'immat ad-du'at.
Peace be upon the imams, the leaders, the guides, the chiefs, the authorities, the defenders, the protectors, the people of the reminder, the men in authority, the left ones by Allah, His select, His party, the case of His knowledge, His argument, His path, His light, His proof. Allah's mercy and blessings to be upon them.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about this very beautiful conversation that Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam has with one of his companions. And, of course, he's talking about compulsion and free will and how this is a matter which is between the two matters. It is neither absolute compulsion, neither is it absolute free will. Now, of course, it is recommended that the listeners go and check out the previous programs on this, because it is a very lengthy conversation, but there's various different points which are incredibly important. And of course, we are not able to talk about it in every single one of our sessions. Now, at one point, Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam, he talks about an individual who believes in absolute compulsion. And he says to the companion, who I believe is from Ahwaz, he says, whoever believes in compulsion, absolute compulsion, or what leads to absolute compulsion, considers Allah as being unjust and oppressive, especially if Allah punishes an individual whom Allah Himself has forced into committing sin. So, of course, here we find that Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam, he is setting the stage. He is setting the precursor here. Of course, nobody considers Allah to be unjust, and nobody considers Allah to be oppressive. And so here, Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam is trying to explain and say that, listen, if you believe in absolute compulsion, you believe that Allah is forcing people into committing sins, then Allah is unjust, God forbid, and He is oppressive. And then Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam says that whoever claims that Allah forces His people into their doings must also therefore say that Allah should not punish that individual. And whoever claims that Allah does not punish sinners denies Allah when He says in the Holy Quran that whoever earns evil and his sins beset him on every side, these are the inmates of the fire. And then Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam, he talks about a couple of other verses of the Holy Quran, and he talks about how an individual who claims that Allah forces them into committing sins should therefore say that Allah cannot punish an individual for committing sins. But in the Holy Quran itself, it says that Allah will punish people for their sins because those people have willingly and have voluntarily committed sins. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Hadi alayhi salam. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en/call-of-Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran. Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasem stressed the readiness of the Lebanese resistance to face any possible Israeli aggression against Lebanon. He said any Israeli act of aggression would trigger an advanced version of the 2006 war, when the Tel Aviv regime suffered a humiliating defeat at the hands of Hezbollah.
The Zionist enemy continues to threaten us with military aggression. We respond by means of steadfastness, resistance, and retaliatory strikes. We hereby declare that if they commit a foolish act and attack our territories, there would then be a new version of the July 2006 war.
He warned Israelis that Hezbollah would fight in an even more sophisticated manner in any future confrontation, stressing that the outcome will eventually be a victory for the resistance fighters. Sheikh Qasem was speaking at the 6th International Conference for the Union of Resistance Scholars in Lebanon's capital, Beirut. Representatives of the Palestinian resistance factions also stressed that the United States' all-out support for the Israeli warmongering policies has given a cover to the Israeli regime to continue its atrocities as its genocidal Gaza war has marked 150 days. Hamas official Osama Hamdan stressed that Muslim nations are duty-bound to foil U.S.-Israeli plots against war-torn Gaza.
It is the duty of Arabs and Muslims worldwide to take the initiative and foil Israel's conspiracy of starvation. The countries neighboring the Gaza Strip must not stand idly by and should take a concrete measure, especially for Gazans in the north.
Scholars and thinkers from diverse Muslim countries have come together to voice their support for the Palestinian people and the resistance. They sent a message of solidarity for Palestinians in war-torn Gaza as Israel's unbridled and unfazed brutality continues unabated.
50 scholars, top scholars from 25 countries, they are gathered here, and hopefully they will reach to any kind of the solution, kind of support and solidarity for the people.
The Palestinians are sending a very strong message. That look, you be answerable to this. You know, the accountability is not only in Israel who are the murderers, but accountability should also be there among the Muslims. Why are you not doing anything? So that's why Palestinians are giving that voice. They are struggling. They are saying they're going to fight to the end. And therefore, they say, if you want to help, it's your responsibility. It's not we appealing.
With the Israeli regime's genocidal war in Gaza now in its fifth month and over 30,000 civilian fatalities, scholars in Beirut assert that the resistance in the region has no choice but to continue its armed struggle until the final victory.
The Muslim clerics in support of the resistance have stressed through their discussions and meetings here in Beirut that the Palestinian cause is a reason for unity and solidarity. They say the teachings of the Quran have drawn a roadmap for supporting the Palestinian people in their struggle to free a land considered holy to all Muslims. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
A series of restrictions were imposed on the Yemeni economy following the U.S. redesignation of the Ansarullah movement as a terrorist group earlier this year. This blacklisting has had an impact on the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country, where millions of people are in dire need of aid.
Ansarullah as a political component has no external economic relations or companies in the private sector that have real weight in the national economy. The real goal of the resolution is to blackmail Ansarullah and distort their position in support of Gaza. The Yemeni economy has been in a state of siege for 9 years, and therefore the American measures putting pressure on the local economy we believe will not have much effect, especially since the Yemeni economy has withstood pressure over the past years and adapted to the measures imposed by the exiled Yemeni government in Riyadh. The Central Bank of Yemen will also work to impose procedures to secure the transfer of foreign exchange to and from Yemen.
Several international companies, including the money transfer company Western Union, have suspended their activities in Yemen, severely affecting the livelihoods of most Yemenis who rely on financial support from relatives abroad. Experts predict that such actions will lead to the creation of a black market for those benefiting from the suspension of money transfers.
The United States of America imposed collective punishment on the Yemeni people. Very important financial channels were stopped, such as Western Union, which is one of the most important money transfer networks in the world. And through it, Yemeni expatriates in American and European countries used to send money to their families in Yemen easily. We have 6 million expatriates outside the country and thousands of Yemeni families depend on them to provide a living. You can imagine what the situation will become after these financial transfers stop. The beneficiaries of this measure are black market workers who exploit these circumstances by deducing a percentage of their remittances and transfer them through illegal channels.
In an effort to deter Yemen's naval operations against vessels linked to the United States, the United Kingdom, and Israel in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, the U.S. Department of State blacklisted the Ansarullah movement as a specially designated global terrorist group. However, this designation has primarily affected the humanitarian situation, as members of the Ansarullah movement have no investments abroad.
Observers believe that Washington's recent measures are aimed at inciting the Yemeni people to take to the streets in opposition to the Ansarullah movement as a strategic move to undermine the group's popularity in the country. But that plot does not look like it will succeed, given the widespread support for Ansarullah in Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
It was the second occasion on which Pakistani lawmakers elected Shehbaz Sharif as the new premier of the country. Shehbaz Sharif assumed office as Pakistan's prime minister for the first time in April 2022, following the dramatic ouster of Pakistan's jailed ex-prime minister Imran Khan from power through a parliamentary no-confidence vote. Sharif, the younger brother of Pakistan's three-time Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, secured 201 votes in the lower house of the parliament. He emerged victorious over his rival Omar Ayub Khan of the PTI party led by jailed ex-PM Khan, who managed to secure 92 votes. A candidate needs a simple majority of votes in the 336-member house to win the post.
From the deepest core of my heart, I thank those who with their votes and love elected me as the leader of this house. People have been given a split mandate in the general elections, and those having reservations about election results need to approach the appropriate forums. We have no personal egos, and the other side also needs to follow the suit for the sake of Pakistan.
The election of the new Pakistani premier was marred by nationwide protests by the supporters of imprisoned Imran Khan against alleged rigging in the recently held elections. Several party workers who were staging protest demonstrations against results manipulation in the recently held elections were arrested.
I am here to request Election Commission of Pakistan, the Judiciary of Pakistan and Chief Secretary of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa to take strict action against the ROs, the DROs, who not only violated the Election Act and election rules and oath of their offices, but also violated Constitution of Pakistan, in which preamble states that the people of Pakistan will decide the fate of their representatives through ballot.
The newly elected Premier Sharif, who is expected to take the oath of the office on Monday, has been congratulated by several neighboring countries, including China, Iran, and Turkey.
As Shehbaz Sharif assumes the role of Prime Minister for a second time, he is pitted against a multitude of challenges. These include fragile economic and political conditions. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
South Korean doctors rallied Sunday, threatening to go on strike following the government's decision to increase the quota for incoming medical students from about 3,000 to 5,000. Doctors say the measures will not necessarily alleviate the shortage of physicians in less desirable specialties and locations.
In essential medical care, the conditions are relatively poor and there are legal burdens such as frequent criminal lawsuits compared to non-essential medical care. It cannot be said with certainty that the increased number of doctors will flow into essential medical care and rural medical care.
triggered by the government plan, 9,000 resident doctors in training out of 13,000 across the country walked out on February 20th. Patients have been scrambling for care with hospitals understaffed.
The government wants to win the general election by winning votes from the people, and that is why it is ultimately implementing populist policies without making a scientific or rational decision and without any preparation.
Polls suggest the South Korean public largely supports the government, and President Yoon Suk-yeol has seen his approval ratings increase since the standoff with doctors emerged. The government has filed criminal complaints against the leaders of the Korea Medical Association who organized this rally. Doctors who fail to comply with the back-to-work order face the suspension of their licenses, fines, and potential jail sentences. Both sides appear to be digging in. Medical schools don't have the capacity to accommodate so many new students, say some administrators. National Assembly elections are scheduled for April 10th. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Italian cities were the scene of rallies in solidarity with Gaza and in condemnation of Israel's inhuman attacks against Palestinian civilians. Rome, Florence, Pisa, Syracuse, Grosseto. For the umpteenth time since early October, tens of thousands of people across Italy took to the streets of their respective cities to express their anger at the Italian government for unconditionally supporting the Israeli regime and at the international community for its complicity in Gaza genocide.
Today, more than ever, international law is just an abstract set of norms which prevails over humanity. Millions of people have died since the Sykes-Picot Accord over 100 years ago, and we're still arguing over the fact that Palestine is a state or not.
We'll go down in history as those who silently supported the genocide period.
Italy has not condemned Israel for the killing of unarmed Palestinians collecting aid in Gaza in an attack that killed more than 100 people on Thursday. However, Rome has called on the Israeli regime to investigate the incident and bring the perpetrators behind the aid massacre to justice.
The Italian police crackdown on students during Palestine solidarity demonstrations in the past weeks has sparked outrage across Italy. Student collectives are at loggerheads with Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni and police over the rise in attacks against students.
The government and police repression has revealed the bare truth. Our country is a democracy only on paper. Ours are simply the democracies of double standards and deception. We have been attacked during our protest for peace in Ukraine, and we are attacked today. We perfectly know how democracies work in Western countries.
Thousands of artists, curators and critics have signed an open letter calling on the Venice Biennale, one of the world's largest contemporary visual art exhibitions, to exclude the Israeli National Pavilion from this year's art exhibition due to the brutal assaults against the civilians in Gaza. However, Italy's culture minister has firmly backed Israel's participation. Max Civili, Rome.
Across France, supporters of Palestine marched to denounce Israel's constant atrocities and war crimes during their latest invasion of Gaza. The world has been stunned by what's been dubbed the Flower Massacre. The death of over 100 Palestinians and the wounding of nearly 800 others after Israeli troops opened fire on civilians waiting for food.
We are here to ask for sanctions and to expose the hypocrisy of those who say they were shocked by the killing of people starving that were getting humanitarian aid, but at the same time don't do anything to stop the genocide.
Some 600,000 people in Gaza, or 25% of the population, are currently at risk of famine.
The French Foreign Ministry said the shootings were unjustifiable and backed a call for an independent investigation by the United Nations. French President Emmanuel Macron demanded truth, justice, respect for international law, and called for an immediate ceasefire.
In the Western world, which is and remains
accomplice with the Israeli genocide, but a slight change in the tone of all those Western leaders, including Emmanuel Macron. Remember that a few months ago, Macron was proposing a military coalition to fight the Palestinian resistance in Gaza.
4 years ago, Macron forced through a bill which equated anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, despite the obvious differences between the two.
Il a deux visages.
Macron is two-faced. It is only since the International Criminal Court announced that they would investigate Israel that Macron began to say just a few words which were not in total support of Israel. He continues to give arms to Israel and is as complicit as the leaders in Tel Aviv.
Many marchers carried signs of deceased United States soldier Aaron Bushnell, who set himself on fire at the Israeli embassy in Washington after declaring that he will no longer be complicit in genocide. After the start of Israel's invasion of Gaza, France imposed a nationwide ban on pro-Palestinian demonstrations around the country. Activists were forced to endure mass arrests, a record number of fines, and the infamous brutality of France's police. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Once a boomtown of the Industrial Revolution, Rochdale in northwest England has been reliably labor for years, until now. This was an election that saw allegations of fraud, desperate attempts like this one by the right-wing Reform Party.
Make sure you prevent George Galloway from being your MP for Rochdale.
And dominated by the massacre in Gaza.
From the river to the sea.
The result came hours after polls closed.
Hereby declare that George Galloway is duly elected.
A sweeping victory for a veteran anti-war pro-Palestine campaigner who reminded everyone that the anger in Britain over the Gaza genocide is not confined to the Muslim community only.
Every Muslim is bitterly angry at Keir Starmer and his misnamed Labour Party. But you would be very foolish if you did not realize that millions of other citizens of our country are.
Rochdale is home to a 30,000-strong Muslim community.
George Galloway for Rochdale.
Apart from bread-and-butter issues such as the declining public services, unemployment, poverty and crime that have racked the constituency for years, for the majority of the voters here, there was more to take into account.
This as a blessing to basically take our word straight to Parliament, and if one person just goes in there, asks for a ceasefire, asks for all these genocide to stop, it's more than any Labour candidate or Labour MP or anyone has done for many years.
He can bring change to us locally, but also nationally and internationally. So the thing is, the ongoing issue with Gaza is a big issue and it's an international issue. But at the same time, it's not just a Muslim issue. It's about human rights.
The election was triggered by the death in January of opposition Labour Party MP Tony Lloyd. He was replaced by this man, Azhar Ali. On voting day, though, Labour's campaign centre lay shuttered after the party abandoned Ali for making anti-Israel remarks.
By-elections don't always represent the wider national picture. They are protest votes with a local focus. Last time around, Labour won the seat here by 10,000 votes, but this time they lost. And perhaps that is a sign of what's to come, both for Labour and the Conservatives, with the general elections only months away. Saeed Pourreza, Rochdale, Greater Manchester.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی است.
And try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من، این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن، دوری از قرآن، از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
کتاب الله.
In the limelight.
In the United States, former President Donald Trump confused Barack Obama for Joe Biden at a rally in Virginia on Saturday, 2nd of March, triggering further questions about the age of the likely Republican presidential nominee. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to a new poll by the New York Times and Siena College, a majority of voters in the United States believe Joe Biden is just too old to be an effective president. According to the poll's results, 73% of all registered voters believe Joe Biden is too old to be effective, in turn revealing spreading concerns about the 81-year-old president's mental competency. Among those who voted for Biden in 2020, 61% believe Biden's age will make him an ineffective president for a second term, with 26% indicating that they strongly agree and 35% indicating that they somewhat agree. The results of the wide-ranging poll, which were first released on Friday, 1st of March, are the latest blow to Joe Biden's election campaign, which has faced a barrage of criticism centered around Biden's age and widespread voters' fear about his ability to be president. At 81, Biden is the oldest president ever to seek re-election, though his likely challenger Donald Trump is only 4 years younger. However, in much recent polling, Joe Biden is usually trailing to Donald Trump, and he also faces high disapproval ratings. In response to whether Biden's age is such a problem that he's not capable of handling the job of president, 45% of total registered voters agreed in the latest New York Times Siena College study. Among those that voted for Biden 4 years ago, 19% said they agreed with the statement. Meanwhile, across all registered voters, 26% expressed that while Biden's age makes him ineffective, he's still able to handle the job of president well enough. Among those that voted for him in 2020, 41% agreed with the statement. In comparison to Joe Biden, 42% of all registered voters believe Donald Trump is just too old to be an effective president. Among those that voted for Trump in 2020, 5% indicated that they strongly agree, while 9% said they somewhat agree. Across all registered voters, 21% believe that the 77-year-old Donald Trump is ineffective, but he's still able to handle the job of president well enough, while only 19% said they believe Trump's age is such a problem that he's not capable of handling the job. The Business Insider has also covered the same story and tells us more. Donald Trump confused Barack Obama for Joe Biden at a rally in Virginia on Saturday, 2nd of March, triggering further questions about the age of the likely Republican presidential nominee who has made a string of such gaffes. It also comes at a time of similar concerns about Joe Biden. At 77 and 81 respectively, Donald Trump and Joe Biden are the oldest people to run for the presidency in American history. Trump on Saturday night, 2nd of March, in Richmond, Virginia, said, "Putin has so little respect for Obama that he's starting to throw around the nuclear word." You heard that, nuclear. He's starting to talk nuclear weapons today. The crowd reportedly went silent as Donald Trump referenced Barack Obama, who left office more than 7 years ago. It's the third time that Donald Trump has made the blunder in the past 6 months. The former US president's other gaffes include confusing his Republican rival Nikki Haley with former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Nikki Haley, 52 years old, who has defied Trump and several primary defeats to continue in the race for the Republican nomination, has tried to frame herself as the younger, healthier option, referring to Donald Trump and Joe Biden as grumpy old men in her campaign advertisements. Trump's mistake came the day after Joe Biden twice confused Ukraine and Gaza as he announced that the US would airdrop humanitarian supplies to Palestinians in Gaza who are dying of starvation due to the Israeli bombardment of the territory. Joe Biden said on Friday, 1st of March, "In the coming days, we're going to join with our friends in Jordan and others who are providing airdrops of additional food and supplies into Ukraine." He added that the United States will seek to open up other avenues into Ukraine, including possibly a marine corridor. A White House official later clarified that Joe Biden meant Gaza and not Ukraine. The gaffe had been changed in the transcript of his remarks. Questions about Biden's age have intensified in recent months. The latest lapse came just days after he was declared fit for duty at his annual health check. White House physician Dr. Kevin O'Connor said Joe Biden fully executes all of his responsibilities without any exemptions or accommodations. A New York Times Siena College opinion poll found that 73% of registered voters polled believed that Joe Biden is simply too old to be an effective president, including 61% of those who voted for him in 2020. Voters seem less bothered about Donald Trump, who is just 4 years younger, with 42% of those polled saying Trump is just too old to be an effective president. While criticisms of the age issue on both sides are laced with political spin, age-related cognitive decline is real. As a person gets older, Changes occur in all parts of the body, including the brain. According to the National Institute on Aging, certain parts of the brain shrink, including those important to learning and other complex mental activities. Communication between neurons becomes less effective, and blood flow in the brain may decrease. Healthy older adults can, however, learn new skills, form new memories, improve vocabulary and language skills. The National Institute on Aging is conducting research on so-called cognitive superagers, the minority of octogenarians and nanogenarians, whose memories are comparable to people 20 to 30 years younger.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi,
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahruddin was...
When we say Divan of Hafiz is a book of Irfan,
Maulavi claims that this Masnavi Ma'navi is the interpretation of the Qur'an.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the religious and scholarly lives of the most outstanding Muslim, Shiite dignitaries, personalities, ulama and scholars during the history of Islam. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, two Islamic scholars from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Rouhani and Shaykh Fadai. Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Shaykh Fadai, assalamu alaikum to you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about another outstanding Shiite ulama of the 7th century Hijra, the author of the book Luhuf. He was considered among the most outstanding scholars, ulama, also mystics or urafa of the 7th century Hijra, Sayyid Ali ibn Musa ibn Jafar ibn Tawus, mainly known as Sayyid ibn Tawus. Before getting to more details of his scholar life, Shaykh Rouhani, I'll be happy with you giving us some information about the early life and biography of Sayyid ibn Tawus.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sayyid ibn Tawus, rahmatullahi alayh, known as Sayyid al-Radi al-Din, or Radi al-Din. He was from Tawus family, which its generation reached to Imam al-Hasan alayhi salatu wassalam. Thus, he was known as Sayyid ibn Tawus, rahmatullahi alayh. He was born on the 589 on Hijri or after Hijra. He was called actually Dhul Hasbain, having two kind of noble sides of birth.
Yes.
Because on one hand, his lineage reached Imam al-Hasan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam, and on the other hand, his great, let's say, grandfather was Dawud ibn al-Hasan al-Muthanna,
yes,
the grandson of Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salatu wassalam. That's why he is called Dhul Hasbain, or yes, Hasbain.
Okay, so from one side, his lineage gets back to Imam Hasan alayhi salam, and from the other side to Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. So he is among the Sadat of Hasan and Hussein.
Hasan and Hussein.
That's right. So these such person are called Dhul Hasbain?
Yes, of course, because of this. Yeah.
Okay.
Of course, he is known as the great narrator of lots of traditions from Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam, but at the same time, he was the great mystic, Arif, and as well as faqih and jurist, yes, in the history of Islam.
Okay, that's right. Thank you very much, Shaykh Rouhani, for a nice introduction. Shaykh Fadail, mostly Sayyid ibn Tawus was known for his zuhd, his piety, righteousness, alongside with his scholarly life and compiling so many outstanding books. You know, he's considered his socio-political life and also religious life, his ethical life, becomes a role model for the following generation of the scholars and the students. Let's talk a little bit about his scholarly life first, then we'll get to his akhlaqi religious life. What courses did he pass? In what houses did he pass them? And what books did he compile?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sayyid ibn Tawus started his studies in the city of Hilla.
Yes.
And first of all, he started to be taught from his father.
Yes.
And then from other great scholars like Fakhar ibn Ma'ad Musavi ibn Namahili, and he had a lot of great students like Allama Hilli.
Yes.
And Hassan ibn Dawud Hilli. And yes, as you mentioned, he has different books, scholarly books, about akhlaq, moralities, and a famous book, Luhuf, about yes. the what happened in Ashura. Yes. Something which is interesting about Sayyid ibn Tawus is a combination between mystics, Irfan, and socio-political life.
Yes.
He was not like some scholars who just stayed in his room and studied and teaches the books and students. No, he had that part, and he was focused on du'as a lot.
Yes.
For example, the book Muhajj al-Da'awat.
Yes.
And Iqbal al-A'mal.
Yes.
These are two important books about du'as. But beside these works and studies, he had a good relationship with the kingdom. Of course, not because he wanted to confirm the kings.
Yes.
By this relationship, he could help the Shiites.
Yes, especially at the time of Mongol attacks.
Yes.
In Baghdad in yes. the year 652.
At that time,
yes.
Yes, at that time, Shias were under a very hard pressure.
Yes.
And if some scholars like Sayyid ibn Tawus didn't have this relationship with the kings, we can say that maybe most of the Shia at that time would be dead.
Yes. And it was so, because the Mongols at the yes. beginning, they started killing so many people, you know, they started their attacks against the Abbasids at that time. So many Muslims
yes.
were killed. But, you know, I think it was the brilliance of some scholars like Khaja Nasiruddin Tusi and Sayyid ibn Tawus to save so many people.
Yes.
It is believed that maybe more than 10,000 of the people were taken with him.
Yes, maybe, you know, about this point, maybe some people accuse these
yes.
scholars.
Yes.
When we know them as an RF,
yes.
why did they have this relationship
mm-hmm.
with the kingdoms?
Yes.
Yes, they were RF.
Yes.
And because of the knowledge of religion, they knew that they have the responsibility to save religion and religious people
mm-hmm.
as well.
That's right.
You know, Sayyid ibn Tawus was invited to the kingdom to have some posts and positions,
yes.
but he didn't accept.
Yes.
It means he didn't want to be in the center of power
mm-hmm.
and wealth. But he only wanted to help people, Shiite people, Muslim
yes.
people. So this combination between knowledge and socio-political life,
mm-hmm.
this combination is very interesting in his life. And
yes.
it can be a pattern for our scholars. Of course, we have a lot of
mm-hmm.
this scholar. We have a lot. But I want to say that scholars like him shouldn't be accused
yes.
Of what they did
right.
according to
okay.
The kingdoms.
One of the positions he was appointed of which was the position of Naqabat, Shaykh Rouhani, in order to take care of the affairs of the Sadat and the orphans of the city and the Muslims of that time. Hulaku, can I say the Mongol king on that time, introduced it. He accepted it, and through that, as you said, he could take care of the lives of so many of the Shiites on that time.
Allah, 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 Allah.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
So all in all, Shaykh Rouhani, Sayyidina Tawus is pictured as a comprehensive character. He's not only a person who is an alim, just teaching, or just in worshipping Allah. He's absolutely busy with the socio-cultural, political, and religious affairs of the people, isn't it?
Yes, as you rightly mentioned, Sayyid ibn Tawus was not only just a jurist or let's say a religious kind of scholar, but also he was a politician or a political figure as well in the history of, yes, of the Shayu. As you see, it is said, it is written in the historical sources that when the Mongol Hulagu,
yes,
Hulagu Khan, the King Hulagu, attacked Baghdad and invaded Baghdad, he collected all the scholars of Islam and Muslim scholars in Baghdad and asked them a very important question, that is a tyrant Muslim king is better or a just non-Muslim king is better for you? Then Sayyid ibn Tawus here said that no, a just king is better than a tyrant one, even if he is a Muslim.
Yes.
So that's why he saved actually the life of many Muslim scholars, many, let's say, Muslims, and particularly
Sultan al-Adil or Sultan
al-Adil is better than Sultan al-Jair.
That's right.
As Amir al-Mu'minin said, al-Hukm yabqa ma'a al-Adil.
Yes.
Wala ma'a al-Zulm.
Yes.
So Zalim cannot, let's say, rule over, for example, the people for a long time, but a just and adil can, yes, do that.
Okay, and through this sentence time and this answer, he saved the lives of so many people,
of
isn't
course,
it?
Yeah. And okay, you know that historically talking, we know at the time of Amawids, thousands of Sadat were killed.
Yes.
Were massacred brutally.
Yes.
And then there were numberless orphans, let's say, people among Sadat, to whom no one could give sadaqah, give charity, give, yes, zakat.
Yes.
So that's why you see that the Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salatu wasalam, in the first time, he collected khums,
yes,
very, let's say, largely
this
to take
happened
care
at the time of Abbasids too, isn't it?
Abbasids as, yes, well, but okay, okay, the Amawids are more.
Yes. Okay.
And then, of course, that's why there was a dire need to someone to take care of these orphans and these Sadat, poor Sadat people in the history. That's why the position of Naqaba or Naqib always were given to some of the Sadat to take care of these people. As you see that this Sayyid ibn Tawus, rahmatullah alayhi, and also he married one of the daughters of one of the ministers,
yes,
who was Shiite, I think.
Yes.
So by the help of this marriage, yes, also he stayed a lot of time in Baghdad and took care of all the
Shayu. We know that when the Mongols attacked Persia and Islamic, yes, lands on that time, by the guidance of people like Khaja Najdeddin Tusi and Sayyid ibn Tawus, they converted into Islam and Shiite, yeah, Islam.
And also,
okay? They spread,
yes,
Islam all across the world on that time. And this was, as I said, the brilliance of some scholars like Sayyid ibn Tawus to do so. But Sheikh Fadl, also Sayyid ibn Tawus is known for paying so much attention to ad'iyah, munajat, you know, these supplications, du'as. And nowadays, when we take a look at the references of so many of the supplications, ziyaratiks, especially on du'as in different Muslims and holy shrines, at the beginning we said that Sayyid ibn Tawus has noticed that this must be read out, for example, in the shrine of this imam or that imam. Where did their own research, his own research, authentic research, or what?
No, Sayyid ibn Tawus had a great library.
Yes.
And as Ethan Kohlberg, one of the famous Orientalists, mentioned in his book about Sayyid ibn Tawus, he mentioned that he had more than 670 books in his library. Of course, this number is just what he could gather.
Yes.
Of course, it is for sure that they had more than this. He was a researcher and a scholar, and besides that, he had a great library. You know, because of his access to the books, to the main books and references, he could gather that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He cared about du'as,
yes,
he had a good access, and he was an expert about that.
Yes.
You know, this is one of the sacred and beneficial services that our scholars did to mm-hmm. our religion.
Yes.
What? I mean, gathering books and saving them.
Yes.
Usually, if you study about our scholars, you can see that they have great libraries.
Yes.
With a lot of books, like Sheikh Tusi, like Sayyid Ibn Tawus.
Yes.
You know, they felt this responsibility to save the books as the references of the knowledge.
Yes.
If they didn't do that, we wouldn't have these knowledges now, because we need main references for that.
Okay.
Sayyid Ibn Tawus did that, and unfortunately in some of the Mongols' attack, most of the books in this library, we lost the books in these attacks, and we can see that usually the tyrant oppressors, they were opposing the knowledge.
Yes.
You know, in the other side, we can see that scholars...
They're barbaric attacks. Yes.
Our scholars cared about the books.
Yes.
And the other side, they tried to destroy the library.
Yes.
What does it mean? It means that the knowledge can save the humanities.
Okay.
Without knowledge, we just have the kingdom of Mongols, I don't know, barbarian kingdoms. The only way to reach the salvation is the real knowledge that some scholars like Sayyid Ibn Tawus saved it for us, and
that's
now
right.
we can use from that.
That's all right. He was also very much concerned with the daily affairs, especially religious rituals of the people. Nowadays we could find so many books translated into many languages, especially Persian, English languages, you know, and encouraging the people to do some recommendations or recommended acts of the Muslims beside the obligations during day and night. Falahu Sa'il is one of them, Iqbalul Amal, we can say now, Muhasabatun Nafs, self-accounting, and so many of the mystical movements, I mean the true ones, based on the Sharia ones, are really following the teachings and the trainings of, especially the spiritual ones of Sayyid Ibn Tawus. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man. And we can say about his demise, it is believed that it was Monday, 5th of Zilqada, the year 664, he passed away in Baghdad. A tomb is attributed to him in Hella. It is not exactly clear whether it is his tomb or not. Some people believe that his body was taken into the holy city of Najaf and he was buried beside the tomb of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
And it is good to know that our famous book, Mafatih al-Jannah, is mostly based on the works of Sayyid Ibn Tawus.
Sheikh Abbas al-Ghami benefited very much from his books. That's right, that's right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Fadai and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the life account of Sayyid Ibn Tawus. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.